One of the tremendous aspects of this program is we can tap into specialists and experts who just know what they're doing and bring you the kind of information that you need to hear, and then you do what you want with it. Such is the case with investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe, earthfiles.com. And we'll be back with a series of reports in just a moment with Linda right here on Coast to Coast AM. I want to read you a little story here before we go to Linda. Federal scientists say they have dated coral living near the site of the busted BP oil well in the Gulf of Mexico at 2,000 years old. The U.S. Geological Survey said that it had determined the age of the black coral in the Gulf for the first time. Scientists had been studying the ancient slow-growing corals before BP's oil well blew out April of last year. The corals were found about 21 miles northeast of the BP well, living 1,000 feet below the surface of the Gulf. Now, black corals feed on organic matter sinking to the seafloor, and it could take decades or even centuries to recover them from a disturbance to these ecosystems, according to the scientists. Linda Moulton Howe, of course, is an Emmy Award-winning producer, investigative reporter, and author, and she has her website, earthfiles.com, and also reports for us here on Coast to Coast AM. She's got a series of reports for you. The first one of including what's going on in the Gulf, because Linda, it just hasn't gone away, has it?
No, it is a bad situation. And it was only a month ago on February 19th that microbiologist Samantha Joy, PhD from the University of Georgia, showed images of oil suffocated marine creatures. Those are her words. At the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, 10 miles north of the BP Macondo oil disaster site that I think you were just describing. And she showed a lot of photographs from recent research. Her audience was the American Association for the Advancement of Science at their annual conference in Washington, D.C. It was a year ago, on April 20th, 2010, that the BP Macondo oil well erupted nearly a mile down on the Gulf Sea floor. Between that day and late July 2010, 206 million gallons of crude oil gushed uncontrollably into the Gulf of Mexico, while 770,000 gallons of Corexit were pumped and sprayed into the Gulf to allegedly disperse BP's massive oil slick. Dr. Joy reported finding tube worms so full of oil they suffocated, dead crabs, brittle stars, and starfish. And she told the AAAS audience, quote, "This is Macondo oil on the bottom. This is dead organisms because of oil being deposited on their heads. Magic microbes have consumed only about 10% of the total discharge. The rest of it, we do not know. There is a lot of it out there. We were able to document the impact of the oil leak on the seafloor. In the places we sampled, it was devastating. Often you saw this oily mucus blanketing everything. There are these bacteria in the sea that eat oil, but when their oil-laden waste gets heavy, it falls to the floor. And it must have been falling like a blizzard for months because it has covered everything with its sediment," close quote. Marine scientists have also reported that in just the last 3 months, since January of 2011, 134 stillborn and baby dolphins and adult dolphins have washed up on beaches along 200 miles of coastline from Louisiana east across Mississippi to Gulf Shores, Alabama. That is at least four times the average yearly dolphin mortality rate, and nearly half were newborns or young dolphins.
Mike.
Yes, and 38 dead or stranded sea turtles have also washed up on Gulf beaches since January. Shirley Tillman, a Mississippi Gulf resident for 30 years, told a reporter, quote, "It is so upsetting. I have never found anything like this until after the oil spill," close quote. Well, the same can be said for humans. By June of 2010, worldwide demonstrations were held to protest BP and deepwater oil exploration, and one of the protesters was 47-year-old Robin Young and her two teenagers from Orange Beach, Alabama, southeast of Mobile. Robin had been divorced for 15 years, had worked as a salesperson for Xerox, had done some TV commercial modeling, and she had also started a cleaning company, which is how she became involved with the Gulf Oil disaster cleanup efforts. Robin was not certain at first what happened to her on June 12th and later to her teenagers, but she had a terrible sore throat and coughing. And she learned that other neighbors were complaining about dizziness, nosebleeds, rashes, nausea, and coughing that will not stop. Robin organized the Guardians of the Gulf to help her fellow Gulf residents know about the impact of crude oil and corrects it on humans, animals, and plants. And Robin is now executive director of that organization. And I talked with her recently about how she went from a very healthy, energetic person to feeling so tired all the time that she doesn't want to get out of bed. Here now is Robin Young in Orange Beach, Alabama.
Well, it started on June 12th when we did our worldwide protest. I came home with a massive sore throat, similar to strep throat, and a headache. And several people at the rally had been coughing and complaining of the same things. And I had a sore throat. It went on for weeks. Developed into a cough. The cough then developed into a very nasty wet cough. I was coughing up this strange-looking stuff. So I got on the phone and called a toxicologist I had been working with and described it to him, and they said, that's the Corexit. You're coughing up the Corexit. You must have gotten a really big dose of it. I'm 47 years old, but I've never been sick like this. It just takes it out of you.
Well, now, do you think that all of this boils down to the Obama administration has your data, but takes the position that if 300 or 500 people are sick, that is dispensable when they need the money more for millions?
I would agree with everything you said, except there's a lot more than 300 to 500 people that are documented sick up and down the coast. There's a lot more. I just have 300 in my tiny area. We only have 2,500 full-time residents here.
Mm-hmm.
The toxicologist that came in and worked with me for 2 days and interviewed 15 of my worst cases. They were a variety of cleanup workers off the beach. Some worked in the VU program, which is the boat program here. Some work at businesses that are on the beach, and some were just private residents.
You all are just the tip of the iceberg.
Oh, absolutely.
Robin Young says she knows other Gulf residents who are also sick, but have been turned away by medical doctors who don't want the political problems of reporting Corexit and crude oil illnesses in communities that depend on tourism for money. But one medical doctor is not only seeing patients sickened at the beaches since the BP oil spill, he has tried to report his increasing cases to the Walton County, Florida Health Department. There, a toxicologist argued there was no hard evidence of a link between the Corexit, crude oil, and human sickness. Very frustrated as he listened to the toxicologist's arguments is Dr. Rodney Soto, MD, a neurologist. Dr. Soto grew up in Ecuador, received his MD there in 1989, moved to the U.S., where he did an internship and residency, followed by a fellowship in vascular neurology and critical care at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. Now, Dr. Soto is based in Santa Rosa Beach, Florida. After the April 20th, 2010, BP oil disaster began, Dr. Soto said by July, he saw an increase in patients he knew were healthy before all the oil and Corexit went into the Gulf, but showed up complaining of similar symptoms, nausea, dizziness, skin lesions, and breathing problems. Here now is Dr. Rodney Soto.
I hear the stories every day. Just a week ago, somebody went to the beach just to walk, and they're having respiratory symptoms. These people don't make things like that.
Right. And the respiratory symptoms, walking the beach in Florida would mean that there are enough chemicals coming off of the water that is still saturated with Corexit and crude oil in enough amounts to have scientists who have been studying this say that they are surprised at how slowly the Corexit has been deteriorating amid the crude oil waters.
Right.
The source of the respiratory problems.
Right. And it irritates the mucous membranes, and people get sore throat and start coughing. I have another patient who's been having shortness of breath for not only weeks, but months now. And all the doctors have been unable to explain the reason why he's short of breath. He's still undergoing testing with me.
What was the first month that you knew that there was a spike in the number of people coming into your office with respiratory and other symptoms?
July or August. And then all the way through November and December, you start seeing a spike on this. And the reason I think it is because a lot of these individuals first, they started going to the regular medical practitioners or the emergency room, and they were being treated with antibiotics or steroids, but they weren't getting better. So these people, when anybody doesn't get better, they'll find some help somehow. You know, I do not just neurology, but I do approaches for holistic health and healing and detoxification as a general measure for anybody to get better. But I think just from knowing of my practice, people start connecting the dots and say, well, he might be able to help me with this.
A lot of medical doctors in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida are refusing to take cases of people who are saying that they are sick because of Corexit and the crude oil.
Yeah, and that actually was mentioned to me by one of the patients that I have seen here, that they were turning patients away from their offices because they don't want to deal with it.
So why would the medical community refuse to be logical that they are dealing now with a population that has been exposed to toxic chemicals?
I think it's more than just the medical community. It's an entire system problem. Doctors nowadays are, in a way, rigorously monitored, and their care has been standardized to a degree that you have to provide a diagnosis that is categorized with a coding number in order for the insurance to pay for. So it's a failure of the entire system when things like this happen and then practitioners are not prepared to handle this. For example, I called the health department myself to report the trend that I'm seeing, because it's not just one case or two cases or three cases, but with several cases. So I pick up the phone and I say, well, I'm seeing this, and I think you all should be aware, and we may need to provide more information. I mean, I just said more information. We don't want to create panic in the population or destroy the industry for any way. No, we don't want that. But I think that if we give information, at least people will have something at hand to make their best decision.
Have you had communication with the health department since then?
No, I barely talked to the director there of the environmental section, and they contacted me with one of the state toxicologists, which I talked for about almost 40 minutes with him without getting anywhere.
Meaning what?
Well, meaning that, you know, I was relaying my information, I was expressing my concerns, and he was basically refuting everything that I could say about it. I even put the example of, well, let's forget about the oil spill. We know for sure that environmental toxins in the supermarket, in the food chain, in the environment, in people's home are causing illnesses in America, and we don't do anything about it, just the health department.
What is your perception on a toxicologist in the Walton County, Florida Health Department not listening to the details of the symptoms that you as a medical doctor have been seeing over the last 11 months since the oil disaster? Is that not part of that question I was asking, that there seems to be a concerted effort on the part of political entities to suppress any information about people getting sick?
It may well be. I think that for me it was discouraging to hear and to not to even become more interested and say, well, let's look at this. Let's do some education about this. Let's get your cases a look at them. We'll see what's going on. So it was discouraging to know that our own health department here doesn't want to pursue either an investigation or more. Well, they for sure told me that they're doing all the testing and that everything is fine. I just wanted to report what I have been seeing in from my medical expertise, that this is obviously, I mean, think about it. Before the oil spill, we didn't have these people just coming out of the woodwork with all these problems. Come on, you know, people don't make up stuff.
Right.
And then So now we have oil spill and all this popping up. I mean, it's just obvious. I mean, it's not a secret or rocket science to figure this out. Before this oil spill, I didn't see cases like this. Forget it. I mean, this didn't happen before. And now we're seeing all of this. This is, hello, this is just like extremely obvious that something's going on.
And for a toxicologist in the Walton County, Florida Health Department to resist you, a medical doctor who is seeing people on a daily basis, to argue with you about the symptoms and to take a position that everything is fine, doesn't that imply that there has been now a political position taken in the Florida Health Department?
If you want to look at it that way, you know, I think everybody can make his own conclusions about it. I still think that regardless of what intentions are, that we need to unify and disseminate information. And that was my message to them as well and to anybody that I've talked before, that we may not have to rely on the authorities or the health department or anybody to provide our safety net, but rather we as an individuals and community groups, we should get together enough to pass the word around and make people aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now in this era in technology, you have different venues. You have Facebook and many things. People can get and pass the word around easier than years ago.
And George, I would like to extend to our coast audience, especially those in the Gulf, the invitation to please get in touch with me. Okay. My email is earthfiles@earthfiles.com. If you feel like that you have become ill since April of 2010 and that you may fall into the category of people like Robin Young and the patients that Dr. Soto is describing, I would like to be able to follow up with people and learn more. And I have at my earthfiles.com website a lot of the photographs, and one I'm looking at, George, in the middle of my report is an aerial that was taken as late as October 15th, 2010, looking down at the pristine white Orange Beach, Alabama, where there are beautiful blue chairs and umbrellas, and the entire all of the water coming up onto that white beach is brown and full of oil and gunk. It is a metaphor for everything we're talking about. And one more very important piece. Yesterday, I received a foreword from a Reuters article that was published on March 29th. And the headline was, Commerce Department forbids biologists from releasing data regarding Gulf dolphin deaths. I talked to several people in the United States Commerce Department in the NOAA Fisheries Service. And I was able to interview late today a woman named Blair Mays. She has worked for NOAA as a stranding specialist for the last 15 years. She says that she has never seen the number of stillborn and young dolphin deaths that they have been tracking. Her specialty is mammals. But she said that the Reuters report relates to a paragraph that did come out in a three-page letter. It was from NOAA and from National Marine Fisheries, dated February 28th, to Gulf of Mexico Marine Mammal Stranding Network partners. And the paragraph that Reuters focused on, it says, to ensure confidentiality, this is a must, with regard to all data and information collected on, pertaining to, or otherwise related to marine mammals stranded dead or alive. And George, they are trying to build a case against BP.
Good job, Linda. Up next, we're going to talk a little physics. Quantum computers, quantum machines. That's next. Well, if you're not a Coast Insider yet, formerly Streamlink, you can be for just about 25 cents a day, just a quarter. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com and you'll find out all the benefits of having that as part of your package, listening to Coast AM. We'll be back in a moment. More of incredible stories and work by Linda Moulton Howe on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Okay, Linda, a little bit of physics here, huh?
Yeah, just before we get into that, I would like to share at least part of an email that I have received from a New Orleans resident. She writes, "Thanks so much for your story and the medical problems that have followed the 2010 Gulf oil spill disaster. My sister and I do not eat any seafood that comes out of the Gulf now. I cannot tell you how much I miss the seafood. It is a staple here in New Orleans, but I won't risk it. Just in the last week, more oil is pouring onto the beaches and bays along the Gulf." And again, to Coast listeners, you can go to www.earthfiles.com tonight and find contact information for Robin Young, for Dr. Soto, and to write me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com on this very important story that we are at the year anniversary and that the problems are still great. And while that is happening in the Gulf, and in our large macro world around us with so many struggles and problems today, there is the micro world or the subatomic world that may be in high school or college that some Coast listeners heard once upon a time about quantum mechanics mm-hmm. and arguments between Einstein and Bohr and others about what Einstein called spooky action at a distance. And we're going to go down into that world tonight, but not as far as we have always gone before when we come to talking about quantum mechanics. Until 2010, it could be safely be said that all human-made objects moved according to the laws of classical mechanics. But back in March of 2010, a group of scientists designed a gadget that moves in ways that can only be described in quantum mechanics, and the American Association of the Advancement for the Advancement of Science has announced this is their choice for the science breakthrough of 2010. It is the first quantum machine that is big enough to actually see with the human eye in this macro world. Its length is about the width of a human hair, and I have an amazing scanning electron microscope of this in this report at earthfiles.com. This is a first, so I recommend people look at this because I think it's the beginning of a whole new science era. Now, quantum mechanics was first developed in order to explain what people saw atoms and electrons doing, and things that are so small that we can't see them, even though they make up all the matter world around us. If you take the simplest atom, say a hydrogen atom, it has one proton in the nucleus and one electron. The historic classical description that has been used is that the electron orbited the proton similar to the way the Earth orbits around the sun. But it turns out that when you're dealing with atoms and electrons, their masses are so small that you can't say the electron is in any particular location. It's actually in what is called a cloud of probability that surrounds the proton. That means any given electron within one angstrom from that proton is essentially in all places at once until someone tries to measure it. Then the quantum magic of electrons behaving as both particles and waves in the quantum world causes the atom's wave function to collapse into a definite state in which the position of the atom can be learned, but not necessarily its momentum, and vice versa. Well, Professor Andrew Cleland at the University of California, Santa Barbara, has a research goal to try to build the first quantum computer. And what he has done as a breakthrough in science is to build a paddle-shaped resonator. It is no longer than a human hair. He cooled it down to its lowest energy state that is known as a quantum ground state, very near absolute zero. And then he wanted to see in that quantum state, ground state, could they control a tiny measure of vibrational energy that physicists call a phonon, so that the paddle resonator could be vibrated a little and a lot, a at the same time. The tiny paddle is made of a thin film of aluminum nitride that is sandwiched between aluminum layers. And after it's cooled down to 1/200th of a degree above absolute zero, it became the first quantum machine in the macro world to demonstrate quantum behavior of being in two states at once. And the problem is, how do you then measure that the paddle is behaving quantum mechanically? And how do you measure it without causing the waveform collapse to a specific state that destroys the delicate quantum state? Well, Professor Cleland used a phonon, which is a quantum unit of mechanical vibration, sort of like if you pluck a violin string, it will vibrate and you can hear that sound, that tone, because there are trillions of phonons released from a plucked violin string. Well, imagine in his lab, if you could bring it down so quiet, so cold, so still, that they could hear one phonon on a specially built superconducting quantum circuit. That's what they did. And the single acoustical phonon could be heard and could be manipulated into a quantum state where the paddle either half the time would have that phonon vibration and half the time it would not. The act of measuring forced the paddle to be in either one state or the other, and that is a quantum superposition state like the famous Schrodinger's cat thought experiment, where the cat is both alive and dead in a box of all quantum states until the lid is opened and the consciousness looks in and sees if the cat is dead or alive. Well, recently I talked with Professor Andrew Cleland about his breakthrough of creating the first quantum machine in the macro world that could be controlled in superposition of two vibrating states at the same time. Here now is Professor Andrew Cleland from UC Santa Barbara.
We could put the paddle in the state where it was both vibrating, so it had one phonon, and it did not have one phonon at the same time. And that's a superposition state.
Which is like Schrodinger's cat that is dead and alive at the same time.
That's right. It's a very, very simple analog of Schrodinger's cat. And then we could measure it and see that the paddle either half the time it would have that vibration, half the time it wouldn't. And our act of measuring it would force it to be in either one state or the other.
Now, how do you take this breakthrough and scale it up? So if I understand, what you're trying to do is come up with a quantum computer that would be working with this vibrational superposition. And I'm not sure exactly how to apply that to the zeros and ones.
You probably at home have one of these light switches where there are two switches that control one light bulb, you know, maybe in two different locations in your house. Both switches maybe have to be on for the light to go on. If both switches are off, then the light is off. Let's say your two light switches are bits in a classical computer. So they're either ones or zeros. They're either on or off. And the light is the result of the computation that you're doing with these two light switches.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're both on, the light is on. If either one of them is off, the light is off.
Okay.
So you can do a very, very simple computation with those two light switches, where only if they're both on, in other words, they're both equal to one, will the light switch be on. There are four possible configurations. You can have the first light switch off, the second light switch off. That's one computation, and the result is the light is off. Another computation you can do is the first light switch on, the second light switch off, and the result is the light is off. Do a third computation, first off, second on, the light is off, and the final computation is both on, in which case the light is on. And you can do those four computations one after the other. And so you could do all four computations in maybe 4 seconds. And a classical computer like a laptop essentially does that, except for it has a whole bunch of these light switches. And it can change the light switches extremely fast, maybe a billion times a second. And that's what a classical computer does. Now, in a quantum computer, let's go back to our two light switches and our light bulb. In a quantum computer, the switches can be both on and off at the same time. And so you can do the four computations that I described to you, you can do all of them at the same time, say 1 second. because you can have the switches in both on and off positions at the same time, and the light bulb will be both on and off at the same time. But by looking at the light bulb, you force the system into one of the possible outcomes.
You are confronted with a quantum computer that is looking at everything on and off, all possibilities at the same time.
Yeah.
Why is it that you wouldn't get all possibilities of answers all the time?
Very good question. And you do. So when you look at the answer, you will get some result. But when you look at the answer, quantum mechanics says you can then also look at the switches and figure out what the result was. So you might say that's not very useful.
Right. It's like you have to have the macro world as a reality check on your quantum calculations.
That's right. So now what you can do in principle is you can scale up this two light switches in one light bulb to thousands of switches and thousands of light bulbs that you put into all possible states at the same time. And you push your go button, and in 1 second, it does a million calculations all at the same time. Now, you might say, what's the good of that? You then have to look at each one to figure out what the answer is. Quantum computers are being built to factor very, very large numbers. Okay, so I can write down a number that has 500 digits in it. And if that number is not prime, I can factor it into its primes.
Mm-hmm.
And if I do this with a classical computer and a 500-digit number, and I want to factor it into its primes, it might take me a year to do that. With a quantum computer, somebody figured out that even though you're limited by this measurement process, you can factor that number extremely quickly in a time that's much, much shorter than what a classical computer can do. So the quantum computer will spit out some, let's say the number you're trying to factor is the product of two prime numbers. So it spits out two numbers. You can then immediately check very easily whether those two prime numbers multiplied together are your answer. It gets very hard to find those prime numbers, but it's very easy to check if they're correct or not. So why is it interesting to factor very large prime numbers? The reason is that right now, the best cryptographic system that's available and is heavily used by banks and by governments and by military is what's called prime number factorization. It's the best encryption system. So what people do is that they take two prime numbers, they multiply them together, and they get a huge number that's not prime, and they use that huge number to encrypt their information. They then transmit the information to a friend who has one of the prime numbers, and he can then decrypt it. And this is how banks, governments, and the military communicate pretty much worldwide, an almost unbreakable system. And if you continually change your prime numbers, it's very hard for anybody to crack it. If somebody can build a quantum computer with all that it promises to be, that decryption can then occur in real time. That would mean that all of the encryption that's used by banks, by governments, and by the military would be crackable. And that would mean that there's no way to transmit information in a really encrypted fashion.
And so how does your breakthrough lab experiment demonstrating quantum behavior in a macro object solve that problem?
We're trying to build a quantum computer, and this is a very long process. Right now, we can build a very simple quantum computer that has four switches in it, and those four switches control one light bulb. We need to get this to the point where we can have thousands of switches controlling thousands of light bulbs. Part of the key to doing that is to being able to store quantum information during the process that you're doing these calculations. And you need to store it in a way that it preserves entanglement. And so this experiment on this mechanical device and similar experiments that we've been doing using light storage systems that are similar to the vibrational storage system that was in this paper are very, very likely to be used in a quantum computer architecture for storing information while preserving the entanglement.
Entanglement is key to encryption?
It's key to this particular method of decoding encrypted information. The information is classical, but in order to decode it in a very fast, real-time fashion, you need entanglement.
You are then going to make a quantum computer that would be able to crack every prime number code in the world.
Yes. And so this is funded by the federal government, because they're very nervous that someone will build a quantum computer and they won't be able to use their codes anymore. So what they're doing is they're funding groups pursuing different approaches to trying to build a quantum computer to find out if it is feasible in the next few decades to build such a computer. Because if someone can build it, I think the federal government would like to be the one that has it. And furthermore, it tells them that they need to find a new way to encrypt information. And of course, the banks would too, the military, et cetera. So it's a very scary thing if it's possible to build one. And we're not at the point where we can say that it can be built. The idea is there, but physically building it, that it would actually do this, is really a challenge.
What would be the option that the government and banks would have if there are quantum computers?
So in parallel with developing a quantum computer, people are building systems that are called quantum cryptography systems. And these are ones even a quantum computer would not be able to crack. They're working on both sides of the problem, finding out if you can crack classical codes and building quantum codes that are in principle not crackable.
What would be uncrackable to a quantum computer?
You build a system that transmits information, say in light, that is quantum entangled. And you can do that in such a way that if an eavesdropper, foreign government, or a criminal that's trying to rob a bank, you would be able to tell that he's eavesdropping, and you can entangle it in a way that the eavesdropper cannot get any real information out. It's impossible.
You're the first physicist to demonstrate that at least quantum behavior at the vibrational level could be translated into the macro world.
Yeah, the biggest things that people had seen quantum behavior in prior to our experiment was things with sort of 60 to 100 atoms in them. So whether that's macroscopic or not is kind of where you define things. They were certainly much bigger than atoms, but they weren't things that you could see. And we've brought it up to something that you can just barely see if you have good eyesight. There are probably half a dozen groups around the world that are trying to do the same thing with much, much bigger objects.
Well, what will the next step of research be in your lab?
Well, what we're working on is we're trying to develop a way to generate encrypted information using these quantum mechanical devices, but we're not anywhere close to achieving that.
How long do you think before you might have a quantum computer that can, in a few seconds, do prime numbers?
Of interest to a government? I would say the earliest that I could see that happening is probably about 10 years. And it may prove that we don't have the technology to do it. But I think in 10 years, we'll know for sure.
And George, when you realize that if some other nation or country comes up with a quantum computer first that can factor these large prime numbers, and suddenly the encryption system of banks and government and military are vulnerable, and that the next stage is entangling photons, some kind of entangled light system, and that in 10 years they're going to know, hopefully, whether they can do a quantum computer. But can you imagine the planet moving so quickly trying to come up with entangled light as an encryption system?
If Albert Einstein were alive today. Hey, I've got about a minute left. How did your last conference go?
Phoenix was terrific. There was 1,500 people there in that audience. And upcoming, I leave for the Ozark conference. It's April 8th through 10th in Eureka Springs, one of everybody's favorite conferences because it's in that beautiful Victorian town. And at the top of earthfiles.com, I've got hot links to speakers and registration information about the Ozark conference that's coming up next week. And then the next week after that, I'll be in Jackson, Mississippi at the Jackson Convention Center for the very first 2011 Mississippi UFO conference that is being held there. And then in July at the end is MUFON.
All right, super. We'll be back with more with Linda Moulton-Howe. Get ready.